Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and I am so excited. I have award-winning author Adam Sykes here, and we're going to talk about his book, The Underhanded. And this is brought to you by MJ Network, which is a memory of my sister Marcia Joyce, who started me on this trip a long time ago. So welcome to MJ Network, Adam, and I'm so excited that you're here.
Thank you, Fran. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, this book got me. I really explain the prologue at Moshe and how come. I had plenty of issues for that one.
So Moser, he's a tragic character because he's the first one we meet in this book called The Underhanded.
Yeah, I know.
Which just released today, April 2nd. And we find him in Germany. And you get the sense from the first couple pages that he kind of struggles mm-hmm. with certain things in life, but he's not who we think he is. He was sent there from Russia to do a job, and he's been in Germany for a few years, and he finally gets the signal from his Russian intelligence handler to do the job. And I'm not going to spoil it for readers because it just happened today, but he goes to do this, and then he thinks he's going to be going home. He thinks he's all done, and he's going to go back, and he's going to visit his mother's grave. But things take a drastic turn for him, and Moser doesn't get to go home.
I felt so bad because I liked him because he really was trying to do the right thing. That's sad. Now let's meet the guy that's really important. Tell us about William Dresden and his life as a professor, and then something out of the blue happens.
Right. So the protagonist of The Underhanded is a gentleman by the name of Professor William Dresden. And some elements of his life and his backstory are based on an individual I knew, a professor that I had a class with and became friends with many, many years ago when I was at Georgetown. And this professor, the real-life professor, not my character, the real-life professor, in the 1990s, he worked in orphanages in Bosnia during the Balkan Wars. And I had been in the Balkans when I was a Marine back in the 1990s. Mm. I was there in 96 and then again in 98. And so when we met at Georgetown, we had this shared experience and we became friends. And I was really fascinated by his life as an academic, as a historian, and what he did in his younger years when he was working in these orphanages in that tragic conflict. So this friend of mine served as the basis for what my character William Dresden would be. Now, William Dresden is a completely different person from this individual, but we meet William Dresden in Chapter 1, and he's kind of going through a rough patch. He's spent his whole life studying the lesser-known people in history. So rather than studying Napoleon or Teddy Roosevelt or Catherine the Great, he studied the people that surrounded these historical figures and how they influenced and shaped history. But he just got his life's work thrashed in academia. He was criticized. He was accused of fabricating research. So he's in the south of France. That's where we meet him. And then he gets a mysterious call from this woman named Adeline Parker.
Now, she really perked him up. So how does she refer She refers to something, and why does he agree to see her?
Yeah, so she calls her, and he thinks that you know, that she might be a little bit off her rocker. Doesn't know why she's calling.
Just a little.
She's saying things just a little, saying things that don't really make sense, that are fantastical, and a few other things. But then she says, when William is about to hang up, as a lot of us would do if we encountered a phone call like this, she says, "Wait, don't hang up. I know about your father's death, and it wasn't an accident." And that's what grabs William. That statement right there, because you find out in the first chapter that William thinks his father died 20 years ago in a tragic car accident in France. And that's what he thought. Now, he had a very challenging relationship with his father, as we find out in the book later on, that he did not get along well with his father. His mother died when he was very young, and he always thinks fondly of her. But he the male figure in his life was his grandfather. But his father, they had a very troubling relationship. So when Adeline says, "Your father's death was not an accident," that's why he agrees to meet her the next day when he goes to a seaside cafe on the Mediterranean in southern France to meet with this mysterious woman.
That is scary. And that's a dangerous thing to do, because you don't really know what she's really up to either.
That's right. That's right. You don't know if it's if it's going to be a trap, if she's going to try to, you know, especially in this day and age with fraud and blackmail. But fortunately, it's a public place, which he's familiar with, so he feels comfortable going there and figuring this out.
I don't know if I'd be so brave. That's scary. But you got to be careful even now just to walk outside. You got to know where you're going. Got to watch. I grew up in the South Bronx, so I look behind me and in front of me and inside all over the place if I go anywhere. So how did she learn so much about his past, and why did I get a cold feeling the minute she gets involved? Because I didn't trust her from the minute I met her.
Yeah, so she knows almost everything about his past. And
that's scary.
Again, to kind of sink her hooks in a little deeper, she rattles off William's life in just a few minutes in that second chapter as we're, you know, getting to know these characters. She talks about where he grew up, where he went to university, what sports he played, how he did academically. She knows about his experiences in the Balkans, because, again, I based some of his backstory off a real-life figure who had worked in orphanages in the Balkans. So she knows all this stuff, which really unsettles William. And they're having this conversation at the cafe, and she does this, and she reveals that she is an MI6 officer. She works for the British Secret Intelligence Service and says, "We have a file on you, and we know all these things about you, and your father didn't die in an accident, but he was murdered." And again, William is just blown away by all this. But then something happens that really sets this story on its rocket across Europe.
So then we meet these people that really scared me. The Strasbourg Covenants. And how are they the catalyst for what's going to happen? And why do they think they should run the world, not the rest of the people?
Yeah. Well,
I didn't like them at all.
Yeah, they're not supposed to be liked. So, you know, as you know, Fran, I spent 25 years working in U.S. national security. I served for 10 years in uniform with the Marine Corps and then another 15 years with the Central Intelligence Agency. But my whole life, you know, I love history. My earliest childhood memories, I have found I've enjoyed reading about history, whether it was, you know, American history, European history, World War II, elements of the Atlantic era, and all these different components. You know, I just remember reading these books on my grandparents' floors in their houses many, many years ago. I'm an academically trained historian. So With some of my fiction, you know, my first book that I wrote, Landslide, which came out a couple years ago, that was a pretty much straight, bare-bones spy thriller, which kind of was based on some of my experiences at the agency and my involvement with the conflict in Ukraine before the Russian Federation invaded. I was connected to it before the Russian Federation invaded. And, you know, that's what Landslide was about. But this book, I was trying to do something a little different. Again, I love history, so I have this history professor, William Dresden. So I go back to the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, and that's, you know, where Prussia and France at the time, they came into conflict, and, you know, the war culminated with Strasbourg and a few other things. But what I pulled from that was a lot of the sentiment that came out of that conflict, the Franco-Prussian War, served as some of the underpinnings for what would turn into fascism and then the Nazis of World War II. So I took these elements, and I'm an avid reader of people like Steve Barry and Dan Brown and Brad Meltzer and James Rollins. I mean, those are authors, those are my heroes, people I've been reading, you know, for decades. And I, you know, I liked that idea of the historical conspiracy. So I decided, you know, I can take my understanding of history and I can combine it with my experiences being a former intelligence officer. And then that's how I created what's called the Strasbourg Executive, which is this group that is the villain of the underhanded. And they are determined through their efforts to push European countries and politics to an extremist, fascist, far right-wing, authoritarian approach and interaction. And they work secretly. They work behind the scenes. You know, they're not the leaders, but they're the ones supporting leaders. They're the ones influencing behind the scenes and masterminding these events.
That is scary. And I say, I know how the ideology works and all that, but how do people like that, I have to ask this, how do people like that get all this power? Why do people believe them? And how do they fall for that? I mean, there's so much in history like that also. That's scary.
Yeah, it is scary. And the way I kind of pulled it out for this particular story is, you know, right now, if you think of technology and social media and the internet and how communication now is instantaneous and how it can, you know, news stories and events and opinions and perspectives can be broadcasted around the world by anybody. You know, in the past, you think of who had a voice. You know, it was somebody who could be a reporter or maybe a statesman or stateswoman. And these individuals, they are the ones who had the, and I put this in quotes, the microphone to be able to talk to thousands or millions of people. Well, now, you know, what we've seen over the past 20 years, you know, think of the Arab Spring that took place, over a decade ago, and how communication through social media platforms like the former Twitter and other types of social media platforms, communication was rocketing across the Middle East, and everybody was involved, and they were able to, you know, challenge the regimes across the Middle East. So I took that capability with other elements like big data that we're facing now. Every time we use our phones, no matter where we are, they're geolocated because we're using map functions to figure out where we're going. We're, you know, using email. We're using social media. We're looking things up. And there's all these things. There's ad technology or ad tech that's all going around that's being used by algorithms by these companies to help focus ads for what they think we might like to see, whether that's on Facebook or YouTube or these other areas. And so there's all this information that's being collected and used and implemented by a lot of commercial companies for retail services and things along that. But what if there were bad actors that would also have access to this information? And what if they were able to manipulate it? What if they were able to use artificial intelligence and machine learning to manipulate it? towards their view of the world and their perspectives that maybe are not the best for society. Maybe they're exclusionary. Maybe they're extremist. Maybe they're, you know, authoritarian. And then as people consume these things and they're bombarded with it on their feeds and in their emails and on the news, you know, what will they think and how are they going to react?
It's scary. I'm doing something next week, actually, on iotrogenics and AI intelligence in psychology, and I'm a reading specialist with my reading professor. We're going to talk about it, iotrogenics disorder. So I went and I just, you know, emailed, you know, texted, you know, Googled, whatever. And 5 minutes later, they said, oh, would you like to meet us here? Would you like to do that? And I said, and I don't answer that. And there's one agency that's putting the AI in schools. And they say, well, would you like to learn more? I don't answer that. So you're right. The minute you Google something, someone's going to want to know if you want to know more. And usually they want to know for money. That doesn't help. So this was really interesting because actually when I get a book that's, you know, fiction or historical fiction or really nonfiction, I do some research myself just to make sure. So how did you connect this organization to Karl Rhodes, Waters Gibbons, and, of course, someone that we all hate, Himmler?
Yeah. Well, you know, as a novelist, you know, all novelists and all artists, you know, we have the ability to create our literary works or our works of art, mm-hmm. whatever we might be doing, and shape it to tell a story, to entertain, to cause people to think. So although I am a historian and, you know, appreciate and adhere to, you know, sound research and, you know, appreciating the facts of what actually happened in history, for this novel, I wanted to use a little narrative license and make some connections in here. So some of these people that I've kind of, these historical figures I've connected, I didn't focus on someone like Himmler himself, or I didn't focus on someone like Cecil Rhodes or something like that, but I picked someone who, you know, hypothetically could have been connected to these individuals. And so by connecting these lesser known people, that's how I was able to construct this story and this conspiracy and really kind of have a lot of fun and run wild with it as I weaved this tale. And so I was able to draw these threads from the Franco-Prussian War to World War I to World War II through the Cold War to modern times. And again, I didn't focus on the big names of history, but rather the people that hypothetically could have worked or been around these individuals and had access to information or been in a meeting and had influence. And those were the people I created that would have been a part of this Strasbourg executive who would have had their covenants and their agenda to pursue these extremist views.
It's scary that they were able to do it. And I'm sure there are agencies now and organizations that are still trying to do it. Everybody's trying to destroy freedom and democracy. So then we meet Sophia. And she comes to head the executives. And why did they decide that some people had to go? And what's her ideology and plans for the world? She's just as dangerous as they are. Well, like they want you to think she is. She's, oh, my God. I wouldn't want to be on her bad side.
So this is a bit of a spoiler. And so if Sophia is not a nice person. And
no, she's not.
You find out later in the book, probably about midway through, you find out who she's connected to. And you also learn about her background and what has caused her, what has driven her to kind of have this view of the world that she does. And then you, in a way, you understand some of her very, very, lack of better term, evil behavior. And you understand how she could, a person like this could have been influenced over the years to become what she is when we meet her in the novel. But Sophia is a dark character. I would not want to meet her anywhere. I wouldn't want to meet her on an alley or have any type of connection with this woman whatsoever. But she is the main person against William and Adeline in this story.
Well, we shall see, won't we? So William and Adeline get caught in an explosion and bombing. And then we go back to the witch, Sophia, and there's another character that it's like a minor one, but yes, he could cause trouble, is Herr Kanzler. So, and he told her, you see, just like the book I read yesterday, you're not allowed to fail if you have a kill. So why does he tell her that she failed? And now poor Sophia. Oh, well.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are certain organizations out there, and there are certain groups where mistakes are not allowed. And, you know, Sophia, part of the Strasbourg executive, she has in some ways, an antagonistic relationship with the leader of the group, this gentleman who goes by Herr Kanzler, which is the German word for chancellor. And so the chancellor is the leader of the executive, and we meet him fairly early in the book. And so there's this dynamic that's going on here. You know, when we think about books and novels, whether they are genre fiction or if they're literary works or whatever they might be, there's got to be some form of tension or uncertainty or questioning that causes us to keep reading the book. Even in high literature, there's a question we're exploring or that the author is illustrating, and we want to know more about it. And sometimes that question, that desire to seek the answer, is heightened by tension. So if we think about spy thrillers or spy fiction or international thrillers, which is what this book is, every chapter needed to have some form of tension or conflict. Now, it didn't need to be physical. It didn't need to be violent. It didn't need to be the strongest, most, you know, supreme form of tension that I could possibly think of. But there had to be something going on where these characters were trying to find something or achieve something or what their goals were. So each character you'll find, you know, William, he wants to find out the truth about his father and his family. You know, he wants to find out the truth about that. We find out through Adeline, you know, that she is determined to take down the Strasbourg executive because of her own family connections. And then the Kanzler, you know, he's trying to bring right-wing extremist politics back to Europe. He is trying to do that. And Sophia, you know, she has her desires because she wants to do the same to Europe, but she wants to do it differently than the counselor. So we have these four individuals that are going back and forth at different times, and there's this friction between all of them at certain levels. And even though William and Adeline are teamed up together, they have their own internal friction because they don't always trust each other. I mean, you have William, who is suddenly introduced or confronted with this woman, Adeline, who's an intelligence officer. And in many ways, it looks like she's dragging him across Europe to fight the executive. So there's that tension there. And you have Adeline, who's trying to get William to really get on board and to trust her and to do the things that she thinks he should be doing. So, I think that makes it an interesting read for folks.
It did, because the way you wrote each chapter and each character, I begin to think, like, who's going to be dead? Who's going to move? Who's going to win this war? And you sort of, like, pray that if no one wins it, what's going to happen? And maybe there'll be another group that comes in and tries to get them. So that's why I got eye strain reading it, because I couldn't put it down. So now we meet somebody else. Aha, wait. There's more people. And we move and we meet Sir Alfred. And I don't know about him. That's
so,
what I'll say about Sir Alfred.
Yeah, Sir Alfred Graham. He comes into the story because in real intelligence agencies and real intelligence work, as an intelligence officer, you're not just running around the world willy-nilly doing whatever you want. We all have superiors. We all have bosses. We all have people we will report back to. Now, what makes the intelligence community unique is that there are a lot of secrets. Things are compartmented, and not everybody, even though you're in an intelligence organization, you don't know everything that's going on. It's not transparent, and it can't be transparent, because if our adversaries know how we plan to collect secret information and do spy work, they're able to stop us. You know, the example I like to use with folks is shortly after 9/11, the media came out, and this was before I joined the agency. I was still in the Marine Corps at this time. But shortly after 9/11 and the planes crashed into the two towers and Osama bin Laden became enemy number one for us, we were tracking him and listening to his satellite phone calls. He was using a sat phone, and that's how we were following him and listening to his calls. And we were gearing up to go after him and track him down in the Tor Bor Mountains in Afghanistan, and it was a huge operation. Unfortunately, the media found out that that's how we were essentially targeting Osama bin Laden, and they reported on international news that we were, the U.S. intelligence community was tracking and listening to Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda network through their satellite conversations. That very moment, all satellite communications stopped, and we lost track of Osama bin Laden, and it took us another 10 years to find him. And so that's why a lot of intelligence organizations need to keep secrets, is because if we let our adversaries know how we are collecting information or how we're doing the things we need to do for our own security, they're going to either confront us, stop us, or subvert us in some way. So to come back to the story, you know, this is a work of fiction. This is, you know, there's some, you know, there's some very exciting events that are going on that are not real. But I wanted to add a little bit of that, you know, genuine elements of the intelligence community, given my own background. And so Sir Alfred Graham is a senior member of British intelligence. He's one of the elders within, you know, British intelligence community. He's been there for years. He was in the Cold War back with Reagan and Thatcher. You know, he's been around the block, and he's this senior, very senior official. And he, through a family connection, is connected to Adelin, this junior officer, maybe mid-level officer. And he's the one who sent her on this mission to find William and to get his help to fight the executive. So we get to meet him a little bit later on in the book. And he's, you know, essentially providing some support and guidance from the back end. They have to meet secretly. They have to be careful how they meet, because he's still in public. He's not on the run like William is. But they're able to get together, and they're able to have a conversation. And that's where Sir Alfred Graham, that's where he reveals some more shocking information to William. And I can't say it here, because then it'll really spoil things. But that conversation right there. Go ahead.
It's scary, because you don't know, even when you walk into a building, you don't know if they have cameras, and you don't know how that camera can affect you. You can walk into a store, and there was a thing that they just had, and I agreed that it was a good idea. They had AI intelligence and cameras in pharmacists, because stores like Rite Aid and Walgreens were getting robbed, and people were lifting stuff. So they said they just put the cameras in there, whatever, to make sure that people couldn't rob, and they took them out. I thought that was kind of a unique idea, because this way they didn't have to worry about it, because a lot of times people just walk out with stuff and the guards just let them go. They don't care. So you just never know. So as the story becomes more intense, William learns about his father and what happens when he knows the truth, and how does he get haunted by his past. So a lot of times you think about something and you learn what happened in the past and you can't let it go. You just sort of dream about it. That I do know.
Well, he learns that his father had a secret life. He learns that his father did things that are really shocking to William. And then he learns other elements about his family that really unsettle him. I mean, if we think about, you know, we go through life, we have an image of ourselves and we have an image of our family, good, bad, whatever it might be, we still feel, you know, we view ourselves in a certain light, and we also view our parents or relatives or the people who raised us, you know, our siblings, our friends, the people we've known for decades, or maybe they just had a small moment in our life, but we view our past. I mean, we're human creatures. We're a part of humanity, and we are connected to our past. And so if we've gone through life thinking one thing about our parents or the ones who raised us, whoever they might be, and we've understood them to be a certain way, which has influenced how we behave as people, maybe how we interact with our spouse or partner, or how we interact with our children, or how we interact with our friends or other relatives, or maybe how we perceive our friends and their familial relationships, all these things. If we all of a sudden realize that our entire life has been a lie and a sham, what do we do, and how do we react? You know, how do you get through that?
It's scary. I went to a flea market with my sister and the person she was married to, unfortunately. And until this day, I don't know if she was kidding. I have a thing for Raggedy Ann dolls. So I went up to this booth and I said, I want 3 Raggedy Ann dolls because I like them. And she said she wanted a Shirley Temple doll. I go, a what? Well, you were adopted. How would you know? You wouldn't know that I got that. And I looked at her and I said, you are kidding. She never took it back. I said, that explains a lot. She says, why? I said, that's why I'm smarter than you. What can I say? You just don't know. I don't look like anybody, like my father, but not really. And I said, explain. Yeah, no wonder I'm a perfect A student, and you're only a 99. What could I say? So, when Sophia becomes the head of the executive, and she decides to create the board, how does that change things? And who is Faust? And why does she trust him? Because I don't trust anybody.
Yeah, so Faust, he's another mysterious character that we meet fairly early on, and he's connected to Sophia. He's part of the Strasburg executive. But, you know, when I was thinking about what to do for Sophia, I thought about when there's a change of leadership with any organization. It could be a corporation. It could be a government. It could be an office within a government. It could be a military. It could be a country. You know, that doesn't matter what it is. Whenever there's a change in leadership, there's always a change in how that organization functions. Now, there are some institutions that have been around for decades or centuries. You know, I think of the Catholic Church in the Vatican. I mean, that's been around for centuries. But every time there's a new pope, the leadership and tenor of the Catholic Church is going to change a little bit or significantly. When you think about when we have a new president, you know, the tenor of the country changes. For better or for worse, whatever it might be, it's going to evolve. When there's new leadership with a company, whether we're talking something like, you know, Microsoft or Apple, or Williams-Sonoma. Whenever there's a new leadership, there are changes. Some of these changes are visible, that are transparent, that we can all see, and then some changes are internal. Maybe it's different processes or how an organization will function. So when Sophia comes into power, she changes the organization to her desires. Her changes are a little more drastic, and I wouldn't recommend any CEO or anything along the lines doing something similar to what Sophia does. But she comes in and she undergoes some drastic actions to cement her power and then to proceed with her designs for the future of the executive.
That's scary. Now, this is really scary too. William and Adelina are not safe anywhere, basically. So as they move ahead to different places, they're the prime targets. So how do they track them at safe houses? How do they know where they are? I mean, everybody knows where you are, but I'm beginning to think that there were points of cameras, or there were microphones or something, some kind of GPS or tracking device in wherever they went. They always found them. How come?
Well,
just when they think they're safe, they're not.
Yeah. Well, in this day and age, depending where you are in the world, London is a perfect example. That entire city is covered by security CCT cameras that the UK authorities have access to. You cannot walk outside anywhere in London without somehow being located on a camera. Now, when you start adding things like the advent of facial recognition and tracking with our phones and a few other things right there, you know, you can let your mind extrapolate how, if somebody, again, had access to this kind of data, how they could find you. And then if you find willing partners or willing individuals who maybe have their own vulnerabilities, or maybe they need money, or maybe they need medical help or something, they have a motivation, you can manipulate those individuals to give you that information so you can use it for nefarious means. So you're right. William and Adeline, they feel like they are always on their own. No matter where they are, they're being hunted and located. And it's not just the technology that is causing them problems, because they're doing the best they can. They're using burner phones. They're trying not to keep technology around them that can be tracked. But they also realize that everybody they encounter is not always who they seem. And some people that are good are bad, and some people that they thought might have been bad are good. And there's many forces at work here.
It's scary. Now we come to somebody else. I really made a lot of questions. This just proved, people, I read the book. I just want everybody to know. So who is Makita? What does he do? Now, this was really weird. Her laptop turned off, and then it dies, and then it goes back on itself. How in heavenly? That was like, oh, my God. Because sometimes my computer just locks itself and doesn't want to be bothered with my reviews. That's the truth.
So I wanna tell your listeners that this book, The Underheaded, is not a techno thriller. You know, if you read techno thrillers, they're wonderful, fascinating, interesting books, and they're jammed full of all types of technology, and you learn how this technology can work and stuff like that. You know, like I said, I'm an academically trained historian. I'm not an engineer. I'm not a computer scientist. So although I bring in these elements of technology, you know, the book isn't a techno thriller in that sense. And one of the reasons is because, you know, I just don't have the background to really dig into peel apart how all these systems work. But what I do understand from my time in the intelligence community, and, you know, now my time with what I do in the private sector, you know, I'm aware of the aspects of ad tech and cyber and big data and how we're using AI and machine learning and other types of things to run our daily lives and how these things can help us. So for this, you know, with everything that we have going on and everything that these characters had to do, there had to be a cyber component. So Makita, he comes in. And, or Mika, he comes in, and he's going to help them hack into a financial firm so that they can keep peeling apart the onion, you know, so William and Adeline can keep peeling apart the onion of this mystery. And so Mika comes in, and he's going to help them do some cyber hacking. And, you know, Adeline, you know, because I'm the author and I can make people have certain backgrounds and skills, you know, she also has a cyber background. So they set up their cyber capabilities. And I talked to some very dear friends and family members who are these technical wizards. And I said, hey, how could this work? And how would they do this? And how could you set this up in a kitchen, you know, not in like a science Star Trek environment where you have access to all these servers and stuff. How could we do this in the kitchen? And so I talked with my friends and said, well, these are some of the tools you could use that, you know, are at, you know, available to anybody. So what they do, he comes in and he helps them hack into a financial firm's back room, their back area that's not connected or visible to the rest of the public. And once they get in there, William recognizes one of the names of somebody he knows who he didn't think was connected to any of this, another individual from his past. And again, William is just rocked with this realization that his life is not what he thought it was.
Okay, before I forget, this is a big one too on Monday. Reverend Pastor Dr. Gloria Mitchell is taking the spotlight on Monday with her Garbage Man series called I Trust Him. And I'm so honored that she's doing this, and she's doing it at 7 o'clock in the morning because I'm due at 10, and she said it's okay. On the 10th, Dr. George Cavuto, my reading professor from college, and I'm going to talk about iatrogenics. On the 15th, Shelley Froman will be here with Fast Times in Big City. On the 17th, Some Kind of Truth. And on the 18th, get this, I had to read three books for this one. R.G. Belsky, Dick is going to be here with his Dana Berry series. And there are three books that Fran is going to talk about. And on the 23rd, I hope it comes, Baron Bishop, and his brand new book is coming out also this month, too. So I'm excited. And anybody that has a new book, you better tell me because my show is booked till the end of August. For real, I think. Yes. It's got, really. So here we go. Why are there no empathy or feeling for anybody? And how did you decide on the scenes between William and Adeline and Sophia? And why does she think that she could get away with everything? I like somebody like that, actually.
Well, without revealing too much, Sophia, I think listeners have probably gathered, you know, she's a sociopath. And so she has her extreme hate, but she's also callous and has no emotion or no feeling for those around her. And so, you know, she's an element of a sociopath that just views this world in a very different way. And she is driving the executive to subvert and take down Adeline and William because she knows that those two, they're on a course that could stop her plans. So in addition to her desire to, you know, exacerbate tensions in Europe and bring in another authoritarian era, she also knows she has to stop and subvert William and Adeline.
So there's another character. Let me put this in front of me. I could see better. We have Reginald. And what's his deal with William? And why did you include him in the story? What's his goal? Without giving that away. I left out some of the words of the question.
He's from William's past, and William had a good relationship with Reginald. And so that's where William, again, he's trying to uncover, he's realizing that his past, his life, is the key to stopping the executive. And so he's got to confront this individual and talk to him and try to figure out why he did things. And this man also has answers that are going to help William continue on their quest.
Now, somehow Sophia has this thing for getting in touch with William. So what deal does she want? And what are the stakes? Because I wouldn't trust her. I wouldn't do anything with her.
Well, in this particular book and in other aspects in the real world, if we want somebody to do something that doesn't want to do it, you have to have some reason to motivate them.
Yeah.
And for Sophia, she finds a way to contact William and Adeline directly. And when she does that, she threatens William with a few elements of his life that he's vulnerable to and demands a meeting to ultimately, in her mind, you know, get rid of Adeline and William. But William agrees to it, less so because of, you know, the point of friction that Sophia is able to create, but he also considers this his opportunity to confront Sophia. And he, you know, Adeline and William don't really agree on how to go about doing this. So, again, we have that literary tension coming back into play here. Because they got to figure out and says, okay, this is most likely a trap. How do we outsmart Sophia? What are we going to do and how are we going to do it? And they have a secret weapon, which I don't want to reveal now, but they
no,
have a secret weapon, so to speak, where they're saying, well, if we do it this way, we have a chance of succeeding. And that brings us, you know, to the finale. And this is not revealing or a spoiler or anything, but, you know, in the beginning of our interview here, Fran, I talked about how the Franco-Prussian War, you know, kind of culminated with this Strasbourg and everything along those lines, where that's in, you know, the name of this villainous group is called the Strasbourg Executive. So, you know, surprise, surprise, the finale ends up in Strasbourg at the cathedral, and it's a dramatic scene going forward, yeah.
You have to read this book, people, or you'll be losing out on a whole lot. Now, this is one of my questions. There are a lot of people in this world that I don't trust. So I've been going through something, I can't say it on the air. And I learned a long time ago that just when you think you can trust somebody, you really can't. So how does the title mirror the personalities of each character? Because even William and Adeline, and of course the rest of them, are underhanded. And that's a powerful word. And by the way, I have hands out for this book, a lot of them.
Yeah, so the title for this book went through a number of iterations, and we were trying to think about what would grab readers, because I am the first one to admit that when I walk into a bookstore or when I'm looking to buy a book online or something like that and I'm browsing, a cover and the title are two things that I'm going to notice that are going to make me stop, they're going to make me pick up that book, and they're going to make me, you know, find out more what that book is about. And I think that's just the way we are. If you're browsing, you know, there are certain things that are going to attract you and there are certain things that aren't going to attract you. For, you know, we're just humans that way. So for this book, we were trying to think of, hey, what would, you know, what's going on in this book and how are we going to make this resonate with the audience that we have for thrillers and international thrillers and spy fiction. So the underhanded, you know, I think does, one, create a mystery for a potential reader, but I think it also is an element of each character within the story. Everybody is doing something underhanded. Everybody has their own agenda. Sometimes it's a secret agenda. Sometimes it's an overt agenda, but everybody is doing underhanded things. And the Strasbourg Executive is underhanded for, you know, that's its whole, you know, ability to exist. It does things behind the scenes and it manipulates situations and things like that. So the underhanded, we thought, was the best title for what we had.
It does fit. And just when you think you have it right, somebody underplays you and gets you when you don't expect it. That's what's even scarier. And what's even real scary is that there are people in the world that still think they could do that. So what surprises await William, and what's next for these two?
Well, there will be a sequel. It's being written right now. And I'm going to try to do with the underhanded. You know, the characters are going to continue. Certain characters don't make it, and certain characters do make it.
Okay.
And they're going to move forward into the sequel. And it's going to take some different turns and go in different areas. I'm a very diverse reader. I read all types of stuff. I love, you know, books. I love an author like Daniel Silva. There's Gabrielle Alonso.
Yeah, me too.
I've read pretty much all those books. But then I'm also a huge fan of someone like Elliot Ackerman, who he doesn't write series. He writes standalone novels. And these are wonderful books. And I love, you know, what Steve Barry has done, James Rahn. I'm a fan of Hemingway, Margaret Atwood, Tessa Wiegert. I love reading, you know, Deborah Crombie, you know, when it comes to, and Amor Towles. I mean, these are people who are writing everything from mysteries to, you know, upmarket fiction that is getting towards a literary sense to literary works. And so me, for myself, because I'm such a diverse reader, I want to take what I'm going to do, and I've, you know, the landslide and this, the underhanded, they're going to be separate series. These worlds do not connect. But with each book in the series, I'm going to do something a little different and take it a little direction. It's still going to be an international thriller, but there's going to be different components. There's going to be different elements to make it interesting for the audience and to make them, when they pick it up, they say, oh, I really liked the first book in the series, but I really liked the second one too because we were doing this. And then maybe the third one goes this direction. So that's my goal with the sequel to The Underhanded. It's being written right now. Hopefully we'll get it done in a year to be coming out in 2025, yeah.
I have to wait that long. I'll have to be very honest. Because I get the books for free, I don't go into bookstores anymore, ever. I just look on Facebook or something, or somebody's advertising something, and I'll say, would you like me to review your book? And when I get something as ridiculous as, there's an author that I did a lot of work for, put him in a lot of panels and stuff, and you probably would be interested in working, you know, doing a panel about history and stuff like that. And he said, this book was coming out in November, and I said, well, I can schedule an interview with you. I have one with Philip Margolin, always. I keep a special date. I said, would you like me to read your book? He said, you could get it on Amazon. And I just was like, I said, no problem. I just won't read it. And I thought that was kind of not very nice. I usually get the books in the mail, or I get surprises, and I didn't know. So in some cases, like yours, I just said, send it, please.
Yeah.
I only reprint.
Which I was happy to do.
Well, I'm glad. So where can everybody find out about you and your work? And I can't wait for the next one to come out. Seriously.
Oh, thank you, Fred. Thank you, Fred. Yeah, if people want to find out about me, I have a website at adamsikes.com. So that's AdamSikes.com. And you can find my books at all major online retailers. So it's Amazon. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, as well as your local bookstores as well, independent bookstores or you know, some of the larger brick and mortars. It's available there too. It just came out today.
Yep,
as well
it did.
As the audiobook. The audiobook is available as well, and I really, really like what the narrator did. A gentleman named Steve Gamborg, and he did an exceptional job. I thought his voice and his rhythm and his pacing really was what I was thinking as I was writing this book. So that's available now if you'd like to do audiobooks, which I'm a huge fan of those as well. But I'm also on social media. You can find me at Adam_R_Sikes, so Adam R. Sikes. I'm on Instagram, I'm on X, I'm on Threads, as well as on Facebook. So if you'd like to reach out, I hope you do. If you'd like to hear about new books that are coming, I have a newsletter. You can register or sign up for it on my website. It's called The Black Cash. I get that out every month or so. And I don't talk just about my books because that's boring. I don't want to just talk about my books. But we talk about the world of spy fiction and thrillers, as well as I like to also talk about, you know, the real world of espionage and a little bit of fact versus fiction versus what we see in the movies versus what you might encounter in real life. And my next issue that hopefully if I can get it done, which will be coming out in the next week or so, we'll be talking about fiction authors who write,
oh, nice,
from my perspective, who write realistic fiction about covert action and special operations. And there's some amazing authors out there, super talented. So I'm going to be talking about, you know, the reality of covert action, because that's what I used to do with the CIA, the reality of covert action and special operations. And some authors out there that are writing really good fiction series that are true to real life and stuff like that. So.
You have to send them to me to review. I just finished reading and reviewing. It's in the 1930s. It's a new kind of genre for him. Robert De Goni's A Kill on the Hill. Absolutely
Oh.
the best. and he's got a new character that's a young guy, and there's like 400 pages. I just read it 2 days ago. I couldn't put it down. It's not coming out till next week. I just posted my review of your book on Facebook, forget about them, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Now, I'm going to tell you about LinkedIn before we go. LinkedIn, everybody on LinkedIn reads my work, and in about 5 minutes, I'll get about 30 views. And I'll get it in about 10 minutes. One book I read was a cozy romance novel. I got over 1,000 views, and people were buying it. I said, get my book too, Mirror Image. My book is called Mirror Image. It came out in January, and some people like it and some people don't. If you do something wrong, you're facing the mirror, and the mirror is going to replay your act of doing something wrong. If you don't redeem yourself and do the whole thing over the right way, you become a face in the mirror forever. You playing the act. It teaches people that they shouldn't do the wrong thing. And some people like what I wrote, and some people don't. I think it's one of my better ones. Well, what can I say? But, Adam, thank you so much. You brightened my whole morning. This is really great. I emailed you the review. And like I said, there's a lot of people that are reading it as we speak, because whenever I write something on my review site or put it on LinkedIn or Twitter, which is X, everybody reads it. So everybody, I think it's beautiful, yeah. Would you believe that? They got it wrong. It's not raining. The sun's out. That's great. Everybody, and thank you so much. Everybody have a great day. Stay safe, and bye.